Good morning and welcome to Beyond the Headlines. I'm your host, Kimberly Watada. Beyond the Headlines is a weekly current affairs show that aims to make public policy discussions more accessible to you. We take you beyond the headlines of our daily news, bringing you access to current leaders through in-depth interviews. This week's show is a special edition of Beyond the Headlines, presented to you by the United Nations High-Level Political Forum Delegation of the Young Diplomats of Canada. You can join us in the conversation by tweeting at us on Twitter at beyond_headlines. That's BYOND_headlines. In 2015, 193 member countries of the United Nations agreed to 17 Sustainable Development Goals, also known as the SDGs, to be achieved by 2030. The SDGs are meant to be a shared blueprint for peace and prosperity by improving health and education, reducing inequality, and spurring economic growth, all the while tackling climate change and preserving our environment. Now that it's 2023, the clock is ticking and the road to 2030 is at its halfway point. That raises the question, are these goals still within reach, or is this an impossible dream? Myself and three other Canadian youth made it our mission to answer this question when we attended the annual High-Level Political Forum on Sustainable Development, which is the central UN platform for the follow-up and review of the SDGs. In just a moment, you will hear from my fellow delegates as we chat about where Canada's progress is with the 2030 SDGs, what it's like to participate in a UN conference of this magnitude, and some of the key trends to look out for as the clock to 2030 counts down. Our first guest is Joe Noss, who works as a consultant for Deloitte's public sector transformation practice, focusing on human services and digital ID technology to support complex transformations of Canadian government systems. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's talk about Canada and the SDGs. And that's no simple task, because as you know, there are 17 different SDGs with 169 total underlying targets to achieve. So I want to start by asking you which SDGs you think Canada has made the most progress on so far and why we've been successful in those areas.
On the final day of the High-Level Political Forum, we actually had the pleasure of seeing the Canadian delegation present their voluntary national review as to the progress of our country on many of the key sustainable development goals. I was really impressed as to not only the progress Canada has made on many of the sustainable development goals, but also the humility and honesty they had in presenting them. One of the Romanian ministers we actually saw speak at the High-Level Political Forum mentioned how so many delegations talk with such rose-colored glasses about the progress their nation has had, and Canada was actually not one to do that. They were very serious about where they still need to progress and where they had made progress. So, for example, one of the greatest areas where Canada had made huge progress was in poverty reduction, which specifically relates to SDG 1, end poverty in all its forms anywhere. Specifically, our poverty rate has gone from 14.5% in 2015 to 7.4% in 2021. And we still plan to reduce it more, but that actually surpasses already the 2030 target laid out for the Sustainable Development Goals. That is amazing, but it's interesting because it's one of the flip side implications or positive ramifications from COVID, right? Due to CERB, due to these key social assistance style benefits that were administered by the government, we actually saw a huge reduction in poverty through the COVID pandemic. Interestingly, the poverty rate actually has risen a little bit, 1 percentage point since 2020 to 2021, but still Canada has made like such progress in that regard. Another key policy that Minister Karina Gold mentioned as being critical to this poverty reduction was the administration of the Canada Child Tax Benefit that the Liberal Party enacted right when they came in, right? So that combination of those two things, those social assistance style benefits like CERB and the Canada Child Tax Benefit, ultimately really had a huge impact in poverty reduction, which I think is just one of the most base sustainable development goals. And that's the reason why it's number one, right? An example of where Canada still has more progress to make, as well as Canada being quite honest in terms of its reporting, comes in regards to the SDG 2, end hunger and achieve food security. Canada was actually more food secure in terms of, for example, persons in female lone parent families or non-elderly persons who are not in an economic family. These sorts of economic units are what Statistics Canada uses to indicate, okay, what proportions of people and family living are food insecure? And surprisingly, between 2018 and 2021, it actually went up 2 percentage points from around 11% to around 13%, right? So that's actually an example of a deterioration in progress towards the SDGs. Many commentators and sort of political analysts and policy analysts have pointed to this being caused largely by inflation, by some of the issues caused during the pandemic. But ultimately, the Canadian government understands that it does need to do a lot of work to deal with this food insecurity issue. And it's actually quite alarming because, for example, sugar has gone up around 42% since COVID. And that has knock-on effects for almost all food products that are consumed by a family. So this is an example of an SDG where, one, I think Canada has been quite honest. Two, I think there's a lot of work to be done. And three, I'm a little worried about our ability to reach our 2030 goals. So just like the flip side of both of these, I would say, is SDG 6, which is ensure availability and sustainable management of water. We've made great progress. And the indicator for this, indicator 6.4.1, is the water quality in rivers, right? And so we have seen just an increase in the water quality since 2016. And Canada is quite confident about our continued progress in that regard. Whereas, for example, SDG 3, ensure healthy lives and promote well-being for all, an indicator is the percentage of Canadians who perceive their mental health as very good to excellent, right? And in this regard, largely caused by COVID, we've actually seen somewhat of a deterioration between all persons, like females, males, those aged 18 to 34, those who are elderly. Everyone really saw a deterioration in mental health. And that's an indicator, and specifically an SDG, we will need to continue to work on. So I think all of these examples reflect how Canada took seriously its commitments to the SDGs. Canada critically evaluated its progress on a variety of indicators as to how well they have achieved these goals. And finally, Canada understands where it needs to go over the next 7 years to not only achieve the sustainable development goals, but place the country on a continued path to success.
So you do a really great job of highlighting how difficult it is to achieve not just all the SDGs, but in fact, just 2 SDGs at the same time. On one hand, you have all these policies put forward to reduce poverty in Canada, but at the same time, you're trying to fight the battle that is inflation, which is driving food poverty. With so many ways to look at how a country can tackle the SDGs, what role do you think tech will play in shaping our focus?
So I think the role of technology will ultimately be less direct. I think the biggest impacts of innovation in terms of achieving the sustainable development goals is not like some single invention that ultimately made it so much easier to reduce poverty. I think the gains to efficiency that come with technology are ultimately going to be those sources, right? So, for example, the fact that through COVID, we now are able to work virtually and so many people are no longer commuting. So many people are avoiding flights they may have taken for meetings they didn't need to be there in person for. These impacts will have huge reductions in not only CO2 emissions, but also just the reallocation of capital towards achieving sustainable development goals like ending poverty. I also think so much about the advent of AI and its gains to efficiency. leading to an opportunity where so many people in positions right now where they are performing tedious tasks that they don't necessarily need to do can refocus their efforts on the sustainable development goals, poverty reduction, addressing food insecurity, and dealing with climate change, or even researching and developing additional technology and innovations to help achieve these goals. I think with all of these things, though, there's an important flip side, which is gains to efficiency often enable those who hold capital to continue to make more money on the resources and like efforts of their organizations. And I think there needs to be an active effort as these gains to efficiency occur to ensure those capital gains are distributed evenly across society, such that those in poverty, such that those who are food insecure, are able to receive the benefits of it. And so I think Canada, for example, actually has a very progressive tax system that enables this, right? We heard from Minister Bob Rae and Ambassador Bob Rae and Minister Karina Gold about just how seriously Canada takes its foreign like donations and foreign support. And we actually have one of the largest foreign development budgets per capita, right? And so if our private sector organizations are able to generate more profit, they're able to perform better, and that increases the tax revenue of our country, that inherently does in some way ensure the reallocation towards those who need it more, not only in Canada, but also globally.
That's a great example of the way we can recognize and work to mitigate the impact that any sort of tech transition will have on vulnerable populations. These types of trade-offs and impacts are also prevalent in how we handle Canada's vast natural resources. As some background for this next question, in 2021, just over half of Canada's total merchandise exports were our natural resources. And yet, protecting our forests, water sources, and land has become more and more critical with climate change. Can you talk about how Canada has been able to balance economic development with environmental conservation?
So I think this question is quite challenging in terms of the task it places on the Canadian government, right? In order to facilitate the electric transformation that needs to occur across the world, we need a lot of key resources, such as the critical minerals like lithium that are currently in what is known as Ontario's Ring of Fire area, right? We know that Canada actually has stores of all of the most important minerals required to make EV batteries, required to make semiconductor chips that are currently mostly stored or mostly have been identified as being available in countries like China. And so this places Canada, who wants to be an environmental leader, in a strange position, right? How can you tear up a bunch of essentially right now just natural land and natural wildlife in order to mine these minerals that will be critical to ensuring the electric transformation, right? And so I think the Canadian government tries to balance these efforts as best they can by taking seriously environmental concerns, by taking seriously Indigenous communities and the impacts these sorts of developments have. However, like, I don't envy the position. I think it is a trade-off that you can't really get away from. And a lot of people rationalize it as saying, we need these minerals no matter what, right? We are not going to be able to have the electric revolution across the globe unless we can make electric vehicles, and that production requires these minerals. And so if we do not mine them in Canada, they will be mined somewhere else. And we cannot ensure that those other places will have the same commitments to the environment that we will have in Canada. And so that argument, I think, carries some weight. I think it's hard to get away from. I think it's the best sort of rationalization you can make. But ultimately, like, I don't think it necessarily is enough, right? Like, I don't know how terrible these mines will ultimately be to my province of Northern, like in Northern Ontario, in the long term, but they will ultimately lead to huge economic opportunities for the country, which again can then be used to help the most vulnerable populations or to further finance and address the impacts of climate change. The last thing I would say is Canada continues to subsidize its oil and gas industry to a degree that's unconscionable. I believe it's something around like $20 billion. And anytime the government subsidizes any industry, no matter what it is, it distorts markets, right? Like, it is not a policy tool that any economist would really want you to use. It is propping up a failing industry and making something that is not profitable, profitable, right? So we pay, taxpayers pay for these oil and gas companies to destroy our environment and poison like our air. And so that's something where that money should be pulled immediately, while it's ultimately probably politically impossible due to the fact that we live in a democracy where the direct impacts of us pulling that money will be too demonstrable for the populations that'll be impacted, right? Like, I'm thinking of provinces like Alberta. Like, I don't know exactly, I don't have all the answers, and I don't know exactly how you would address that, but I do think right now that subsidization of the oil and gas industry is such a dark stain on Canada's clear and serious efforts towards addressing climate change and protecting the environment.
I definitely agree with you that one of Canada's biggest challenges is the economic and environmental trade-offs that we face in our energy system and electrification in general.
How do we keep holding our place as one of the global energy leaders while reducing emissions and addressing the fact that our oil production is still so high?
I think I'm curious, Kim, you have a little more of a sustainability background. Do you have any ideas on this front, or have you seen any like best practices in that regard?
I mean, I think the biggest question is there a way that we can start pivoting our oil and gas sector in a way that matches with a just transition, but also gives us some sort of clean energy output that we can replace these oil exports with clean exports? I know Canada is doing a lot of work investing in hydrogen.
And a really exciting move was in the most recent proposed 2023 federal budget, which includes a clean hydrogen investment tax credit of up to 40% for eligible clean hydrogen projects.
I'm really excited about this because this was a much needed response to the United States' Inflation Reduction Act, because it ensures that Canadian hydrogen production remains competitive in the global hydrogen production market. And that is crucial if we want to remain leaders in the energy space throughout this energy transition. Is Alberta going to be the next big global hydrogen hub? It's possible. It also, there's a lot of questions and strings attached to that. Are we going to produce hydrogen with natural gas? Will carbon capture be ready in time? There's so many variables to see if we could actually become a clean energy giant as opposed to, you know, an oil and gas giant. So I think we have to keep investing in that innovation and tech that we spoke about earlier.
That hydrogen tax credit is a really good initial step forward.
And we have to be really intentional in making sure that this is a transition and not just a status quo moment when it comes to financing.
Now, I think we could spend a whole podcast talking about Canada's clean energy sector, but instead, I will spin us off to my last question for you, Joe, which is, can you talk about Canada's holistic progress in meeting the 2030 SDG targets?
In regards to Canada's progress towards the 2030 targets, I really left the high-level political forum proud of my country and the position it holds at the United Nations, right? People do truly respect Canada as a partner in international development. They feel we take sustainability and development seriously. And our progress was clear from our voluntary national review, right? We did a really comprehensive job in partnership with Statistics Canada, making clear where we had progressed, where we still needed more work. But ultimately, I think Canada's biggest gaps are those that we mentioned prior, right? It is our per capita greenhouse gas emissions as a nation. It is our historic greenhouse gas emissions as a nation. It is the possibility of future environmental destruction as a result of new mining projects, right? Like, those are where we have huge gaps in terms of achieving the 2030 goals. But ultimately, I think on every other front, on education, on poverty reduction, on health, right, we have made a lot of progress since 2015. I think we'll continue to make a lot of progress. And I'm ultimately proud, after leaving the high-level political forum, to be Canadian and to have been a part of the delegation.
Thanks, Joe. We will continue our discussion after a short musical break. This is Knocking at the Door by the Arkells.
Sister sing, all aboard, and bring your offerings. That's me.
That was Knocking at the Door by the Arkells. Welcome back to Beyond the Headlines. This week, we are joined by the young diplomats of Canada's high-level political forum delegation, talking about sustainable development in Canada. Remember, you can join us in the conversation by tweeting at us on Twitter at beyond_headlines.
Our next guest is Nico Han, who is currently a research analyst at a DC-based think tank. Nico has a wealth of knowledge about international relations, as she holds a master's of philosophy in that field from the University of Oxford, and she's interned at places like the U.S. House of Representatives and the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
All right, Nico, let's get started with hearing about your experience at the HLPF. You and I, we both attended tons of events, from the need for climate financing all the way to learning about how countries can best support vulnerable populations. From all of this, I'm curious, what do you think Canada's biggest call to action should be from the HLPF?
I think Canada's main priority are multifold, really. But if there's one that we can tackle, I think is SDG number 7, which focus on energy and fuel. So the goal specifically is to ensure access to affordable, reliable, sustainable, and modern energy for all. And since SDG goals are all interrelated, I think number 7 really underpins all the challenges. If we could solve the energy access problem and energy efficiency and renewables and all, then essentially we can uplift all other challenges. So I think this is something that Canada can prioritize on. This is easier said than done, because Canada is a resource-rich nation, and we actually rely on exporting natural resources for economic development and contribution to GDP. And even oil and gas is a huge sector for employment, investment, and especially provincial economies. So the energy sector's impact is particularly notable in certain provinces, as we all know, such as Alberta, Saskatchewan, and even Newfoundland and Labrador. So we really rely on oil and gas and other natural resources, and especially given the increasing geopolitical tensions happening in the world, all the Western allies and democratic countries also turn to Canada in a case of emergencies. So this is something that we need to tackle.
One of the other big trends that I noticed from the HLPF was the lingering impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic on the SDGs. Can you talk about how the pandemic has impacted Canada's SDG efforts and the strategies that we've put in place to mitigate its effects?
For sure. The pandemic has caused disruptions to a lot of sectors, as we know, including health, education, economy, and of course, social welfare. And all these disruptions can hamper progress towards the SDG by accelerating poverty, inequality, and health challenges. So some of the things that we could do is to strengthen the healthcare systems and ensure access to medical services and vaccines are all there. And of course, providing financial support and relief measures for individuals and businesses impacted by the economic downturn. And I also see this as an opportunity because the world overall saw actually a dip in the carbon emission during this time, right? So it's also a chance for us to really look at some of the alternatives we can do that turn the economy towards relying on sustainable recovery and clean energies.
I love that last point you just made because green investments used coming out of the pandemic has been such an important public policy tool to spur economies around the world. In addition to green financing, to capitalize on the opportunity to solve the SDGs, we need partnerships. Nico, can you tell us about one of Canada's established partnerships or collaborations with other countries or international organizations to accelerate progress on the SDGs globally?
Sure. Through this experience, what we find out is Canada, in fact, has a lot of partnership with IO or international organizations. So the World Bank, UNICEF, the World Health Organization, all of these tend to leverage Canada's expertise, resources, and knowledge in achieving SDG goals worldwide. But another thing that we have observed is that Canada tend to send on or being present on all these organizations. But even though Canada has signed on for so many organizations and initiatives, what we also realize is that Canada tend to hop on to a lot of initiatives that were already there. And essentially, the global impact would depend on the cooperation of all countries and coordination among their different priorities. And I think Canada has a lot more potential and room to improve in this regard.
I'm curious, actually, based on your experience at the HLPF, how effective do you see the UN as a convening organization to solve these sorts of problems? Because you just mentioned there are a lot of challenges with this kind of international cooperation.
I think there are some big countries like the US, like Saudi Arabia, China, that have what in our field international relations, we call it the do-it-alone power. So essentially have meaningful engagement to embed these countries within international frameworks and agreements is the key to moving the proposal along the pipe. And Canada, as a what a lot of people call middle power, seems to be in the role of mitigating and kind of massaging these ideas from the countries that have more urgent need to hammer down those proposals to other countries that will have a significant impact on achieving these proposals. So Canada plays almost like a broker rules in some of the proposals.
With that in mind, what do you think should be Canada's main priorities and strategies to accelerate progress on the SDGs in the coming years?
I think for Canada, there are two approaches that it can pursue simultaneously. The first is persuade its own domestic energy consumption to go down because we Canadian really enjoy the low price or more convenient access to energy. And we tend to have a lot more emission than any other countries. So educate citizens domestically and installing solars and making energy more efficient, energy use more efficient domestically would help to uplift global emission. And the second approach is to transform our own energy production sector. So for instance, we have a lot more potential for hydroelectricity, nuclear, and all. And that's something that we can also do to become less reliant on fossil fuels as an economy.
And if we were successful in revamping our energy sector towards clean energy, do you think that would be enough for us to step out of that brokerage role that you mentioned and into the role of a clean energy leader on the global scale?
I think we will be leading in many aspects, especially in terms of aiding the developing countries to transform their energy sectors. So there are many ways to define that leadership, right? So in terms of becoming, for example, the leader for exporting solar, then in that regard, we won't be, because there are other countries that are simply more well positioned to have that economy of scale, such as China. But in terms of using our natural advantage, for example, trust with many developing countries and technology transfer and all that, I do think we have an edge in those areas.
Awesome insights. Thanks so much for your time, Nika.
We'll continue our discussion after a short musical break. This is Leather Jacket by The Arkells. Party, she comes straight from work. Complained that the regulars were all a bunch of jerks. She always looked tired. She dazzled as a drunk. She even pulled off a stupid haircut. She said, I don't need a sponsor or the best lover. Some man that sees me as some fixer-upper. The last few years that I've been running for cover. Trying to sleep so I can visit my mother. That was Leather Jacket by The Arkells. Welcome back to Beyond the Headlines. This week, we are joined by the Young Diplomats of Canada's High-Level Political Forum delegation talking about sustainable development in Canada. Remember, you can join us in the conversation by tweeting at us on Twitter at @beyond_headlines.
Our final guest is Topaza Yu, who is a first-year doctoral student in counseling psychology. She also serves on Action Canada's Sexual Health and Rights Board of Directors and is dedicated to anti-racism and anti-oppression, mental health, and sexual and reproductive health and rights. Hi, Topaza. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me on the podcast.
As you know, the SDGs are meant to promote both gender equality and women's empowerment. Can you describe how Canada has worked to advance SDG 5, which is gender equality, both domestically and internationally?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I would say I'm going to start internationally in terms of what Canada has done to promote gender equality and women's empowerment. I think on the international context, I think there's been a lot of work done both in the UN space, but also on the federal space in Canada. And when I speak about the UN space, I'm really alluding to having youth representation at the Commission of Population Development and having those folks talk about what gender equality and women empowerment really means to them on the more international level. And in terms of the domestic level, I can speak a little bit about how the federal government, especially the Minister of Women and Gender Equality sector, they've really put in a lot of budget and also a lot of funding to advance gender equality and continue to promote women's empowerment. And one of the really big examples I would give is the Menstrual Equity Fund, which was very much promoted by Minister Marcy Ian. And the idea of the Menstrual Equity Fund is that I believe the government of Canada was able to budget $25 million for a pilot project to kind of combat period poverty and make sure that menstrual products are available to Canadian youths and also just Canadians who have a uterus and does experience periods. So I think those, both domestically and internationally, Canada has been really strong in terms of promoting gender equality and also women's empowerment. But not only that, but also the intersection of those things.
It's great to hear the strides that we're making in those areas. Could you also share some of the ways that you feel like we could be doing more to advance gender equity in Canada?
I can definitely shed some light about that. I think with my time on the Prime Minister's Youth Council, I've always been a big advocate for an anti-racist and anti-oppression lens to all levels of work that we're doing, no matter what the topic being. So it could be food insecurity or gender equality or immigration issues. But no matter the work that you're doing or no matter the cost that you're advocating for, I think there's always going to be room for improvement in terms of how can we effectively apply an anti-racist and anti-oppression lens to it. And what I really mean by that is that we need to acknowledge that that there are colonialized ideologies that really underpin a lot of the work that we do. And how do we consciously but also unconsciously acknowledge those, and how can we push back against racist and misogynistic and sexist ideologies that really impact all of us?
Definitely agree with that. And, you know, you spoke about a lot of those different aspects of SDG 5 really at a granular level. And the interesting thing about things like gender equality is that it can be applied to all the SDGs. There's 17 of them. And really, you could take that anti-racism, gender equality lens on a lot of those. So my follow-up question to you for this is, how is Canada addressing the intersectionality of the SDGs to ensure that we're, you know, being gender equitable, anti-oppression, et cetera? How are we making sure that this transition is inclusive and leaves no one behind?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a lovely question. And I would say we're not perfect in applying an anti-racist or anti-oppression lens, but I do have to say the one thing that really popped up when you asked that question was for CIHR, they really, really push for sex and gender-based analyses, which means that all of the work that they're doing, all of the funding that they give out to research grants, to academic institutions, to foundations, or to projects is very much through a sex and gender-based analysis lens, and really ensuring that there's equity and that historically marginalized folks are very much considered in these projects and that they are not left behind. So I would say Canada does a really good work in terms of including gender equality, but also considering women's empowerment in certain government agencies. But I think there's still a lot of work to be done in terms of like, how are we being truly anti-racist and truly anti-oppressive in the work that we do?
And on that note, what do you think are some of the ways that youth can be best involved in pushing this gender equality and SDG agenda at large in Canada?
I would say don't be shy. Just there's so many opportunities to be involved in governance and government, but also grassroots organizations that can definitely open doors for youth in terms of like youth participation and youth leadership. So I would say some of the best practices is like, number one, keep an eye out for opportunities. There's a lot being posted these days, even on like social media. So following accounts that you would like to work with because of their initiative or the things that they're advocating aligns with your values, that's always a good way to make connections and also network. I think other ways where as a youth, you can be connected to policy reform and also government branches, I would say just cold emailing. Like, I've definitely done that where I've emailed ministers' offices, and obviously it won't be the ministers who are replying to you, but just getting your name to their staffers and letting them know, hey, I'm really highly interested in opportunities that come up with, let's say, Mr. Marcy Ian, if anything arises, please contact me. And you just never know what happens when you put your name out there. So I would say don't be afraid to network, and also just ask for opportunities. And sometimes they might just have like an unrestricted budget and you can create your own opportunities, or you can just recommend and self-nominate yourself to be, say, part of a delegation for a UN conference. So there's lots of different ways that you can be involved for sure.
Maybe let's speak about that. And what by that, I mean our experience at the most recent UNHLPF. As a youth delegate in the Canadian delegation, can you tell us a bit about your experience and what you're able to take away from that?
Yeah, definitely. My experience with HLPF and with YDC has been very positive. It was a very great experience in terms of different side events that we were able to network with different stakeholders, government authorities, but also just with your peers. And my delegation was very much a supportive group. So it was great to not only learn from each other, but also challenge each other's ideologies and be able to be in like-minded spaces and share about our expertise in a very safe and brave space. I think the biggest takeaway for me in terms of HLPF is the concept of the personal is too political, in terms of even though you're in these systemic spaces, that all of these policies that you're developing and all of these drafts that you're drafting up in a very high level aspect, it still impacts individuals in a very direct way or even indirectly. So really understanding the intersections between the systemic policy reform, but also the individualized and how individual citizens are impacted by those policies. So I think being at HLPF really gave me a bigger and broader perspective in terms of like, oh wow, like these policies are very much being applied to real life humans, and it's going to impact them in the ways that they will because of their different characteristics and because of their different socioeconomic environment.
Yeah, the great thing about the UN forum was that, like, as you said, I was definitely also empowered by the knowledge that we gained there. And I think that's something that is really important in youth participation with the SDGs, equipping them with the knowledge to go out there and make a difference.
So my last question for you is, how is the knowledge that you've gained from the HLPF going to inform your career in the future?
That's a lovely question. And I think everything that was learned at HLPF is very much translatable into my work as a consultant for anti-racism and anti-oppression and an advocate for sexual and reproductive health and rights, but also as a psychologist in training in terms of learning that the personal is too political and that the policies that we develop very much impacts those around us and it impacts them in different ways. So understanding the different nuances and understanding how we can effectively apply these policies to make them more equitable and representative of the audience and the folks that we're going to be working with.
And that's a wrap on this special episode on Canada and the SDGs from Joe, Nico, Topaza, and I. Overall, the four of us saw a lot of cause for hope from the UN High-Level Political Forum. The knowledge being shared stemmed from genuine action being taken around the world, but there is so much more work to be done. When it comes to the 2030 SDG agenda, the reality is that we're not going to meet things like zero poverty or zero hunger around the world. But what's important is that we keep making progress, we keep innovating to speed up action, and we remember that at the end of the day, we're all in this together, because global cooperation is what will drive global action forward. You have been listening to a special edition of Beyond the Headlines, presented to you by the United Nations High-Level Political Forum Delegation of the Young Diplomats of Canada. The views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, CIUT, the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy, or the Young Diplomats of Canada. Be sure to check out podcasts of all our episodes on our website at www.beyondtheheadlines.net or wherever you get your podcasts. If you're a fan of our show or want to stay up to date with policy issues in Canada, follow us on Twitter at @beyond_headlines. You can also check us out on Facebook or Instagram. Be sure to tune in next week as we continue to take public policy discussions out of the hallways and onto the airwaves.